Now we're studying at the moment on these Sunday mornings the book of Ruth in the Old Testament, and I'm going to invite you to turn in your Bibles there in the seat. Please get them out. Let's have a good look at it together. Help the preacher, and then the preacher will help you. We're looking at page 237. 237. Every now and then I'll direct us to a verse from the scriptures, and then you follow it. You help me. A sermon is something we all make together. We're on page 237, Book of Ruth, chapter 3. As we think about this overall theme of two women and God. And then today's item is entitled The Kinsman. And we begin by turning to a phrase towards the end of verse 13, the words of Boaz to Ruth, the gentle heroine of the book. As the Lord lives, he said, I will do the part of the next of kin for you. Now we're thinking of a period in our world some 31 centuries ago, roughly when the Bronze Age was giving way to the Iron Age. You may be wondering, as you sit in London's West End here at All Souls Church, how the Bible book of Ruth, with its pastoral images of country people back in 1200 BC, can possibly apply to our sophisticated civilization today. Let me tell you. Around the time of Ruth, there were advanced and sophisticated societies in our world. The fall of the great city of Troy took place about then. Not all that far away, on the island of Crete, was the highly developed city of Knossos, now known as Kephala. Excavations earlier this century revealed an elaborate setup of great buildings, staircases, even sanitary systems equipped with water flushes. There, over 1,000 years ago, BC, was a civilization that rose, flourished, and died, probably through violence. Many of its accomplishments had to be reinvented centuries later. The pattern seems to be that a civilization fails from within itself. A Scotsman, after visiting Sir Arthur Evans' excavations at Knossos, made the observation, the moral of Knossos is that good plumbing will not save a civilization. So what does make for true civilized living? The wonderful little Old Testament book of Ruth holds within itself the seeds of a satisfying answer. You see, the book describes a society there in Bethlehem, which was an oasis of harmony and trust within the wider chaos that characterized Israel at the time of the judges. In Israel at large, it was a case of everybody for themselves. It was the law of the jungle. As we read at the end of the book of Judges, in those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And once a society abandons any idea of a universal authority to which all are subject, once integrity and trust are consigned to the scrap heap of human memories, well then you may perhaps drive a Mercedes, gabble into your mobile phone, eat at the Hilton, and sleep in an emperor bed. But you're no longer civilized. The process has started from within. It won't take all that long. A banana republic is the result, if not the blackened ash heap that imperial Rome was reduced to by the Visigoth hordes in 410 AD. No, the book of Ruth does have a message for us today, set as we are in a world where we can hardly think of a single country where stability and harmony are the watchword. The time of the judges was just about the most dehumanized period in the history of Israel, and yet, here in Ruth is a pocket of human warmth and godly standards. Here in Ruth is a Gentile girl who's been converted to the faith of her Jewish mother-in-law, far away in the land of Moab, as disaster strikes, first through famine and then through bereavement. As mother-in-law Naomi wearily prepares to return to her own land of Israel as a sorrowing widow, her Moabite daughter-in-law, also a widow now, refuses to leave her side, as we learnt in our earlier studies. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. Chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. So from the migrants in our first sermon, we turned then to the gleaner in chapter 2, as we saw the two widows, now in Naomi's own hometown of Bethlehem, with Ruth being given access to the harvest fields of Boaz, the old friend and kinsman of Naomi's late husband. Ruth here is the breadwinner on behalf of Naomi and herself, working, begging, gleaning, and the eyes of the whole village are upon the Moabite immigrant, shining among them in her modesty and adopted new faith like a captivating princess. And Boaz is there, prominent and wealthy in Bethlehem, encouraging Ruth to stay in his fields, where no one will get at her, where generous allowances will be made for her. Two women and God. And now the part of Boaz, the kinsman, comes more clearly into focus here in chapter 3. The chapter opens with Naomi in verse 1 telling Ruth, "My daughter," do you see the words there? "Should I not seek a home for you that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman?" Ruth, you see, has been doing her part. Now Naomi is stepping in with a suggestion of an appeal to Boaz to fulfill the obligations of a kinsman, to provide a home and a future for Ruth. In the book of Judges, everybody there was thinking of themselves first. It's different in this gentler environment of Bethlehem. And I ask again, if I may, what makes for a civilized society? It has to be more than the development of a decent infrastructure, or motorways, communications, low inflation rate. That's just not it. I remember on a visit to a remote country district of Kenya where I was born, seeing an old family friend of ours, a Kikuyu pastor called Elijah, or as we called him, Elijah Gashanja, and his wife. They lived in a little community where there were no Western-style facilities, no gas, no electricity, no telephone, no plumbing, of course, of the kind developed in Knossos. But I tell you, it was gracious living there in Kikuyu country, where Christianity had made its mark. "Would you like a cup of tea?" they said. It was funny. I'd forgotten what it was to have a cup of tea in an agricultural setting. And without thinking clearly, I said, "Oh yes, I'd love a cup of tea, thank you." Mrs. Gashanja went quietly outside. Next thing I heard was the sound of the chopping of wood. She was starting that cup of tea from scratch. Chop the wood, light the fire, fetch the water, make the tea, and an hour later I got my cup of tea. All the time, of course, we were talking, exchanging news, catching up on each other. It was gracious and it was civilized. Let's teach ourselves today from this book of Ruth that the ingredients that go into a true civilized society are to do with attitudes, standards, and the things of the spirit. Without those, there is no civilized living. Requirement number one that I identify then is of a place where grace creates the climate. Did you hear our earlier studies in this book of Ruth? Were you here to hear them? If you did, you can't have missed the spirit of modesty, of hospitality and accommodation that characterizes the lives of each participant in this cameo of Jewish life. The words of Boaz were highlighted for us in chapter 2, verse 11 last week, as the kinsman Boaz speaks to Ruth, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord recompense you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That last sentence is the key to the entire book. We notice Ruth's reply in chapter 2, verse 13. "You are most gracious to me, my Lord, for you have comforted and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not one of your maidservants." Indeed, she wasn't. She wasn't even Jewish. But do we find Boaz or anybody else in that gracious society doing as they did centuries later in a far less gracious day when Gentiles were addressed as dogs? Such language and such attitudes would have been completely incongruous in the civilized climate of 12th century BC Bethlehem. Amazingly, the Bible story of country people in the book of Ruth presents us with a model for civilized living. 31 centuries down the line, here in the paranoid, frenetic life of the modern city. Yes, we have to put the principles of the book of Ruth into practice right here. The whole point of being a church here in the West End is to remove the pressures off the newcomer and the stranger within our capital city and off each other. There's enough pressure outside the church for us to be adding to that pressure. So this place here has got to create the climate of a refuge and a home, which is precisely what Naomi and Ruth in their own time were looking for and found among the gracious and hospitable people of Bethlehem. It was only many centuries later that the town became associated with the one-liner of rejection, no room. What makes for a civilized society? Requirement number one seems to be in terms of a place where grace creates the climate. Without that, you can't begin at all. Requirement number two comes to the heart of this third chapter in Ruth. Bethlehem proves itself to be a place, secondly, where duty provides the framework. Naomi recognizes in Boaz what could be called not simply a kinsman, but a redeemer kinsman. What Naomi seems to have had in mind, and what Bethlehem evidently fostered, was the fulfillment of the combined provision of two Old Testament texts. The first was Leviticus 25, verse 25, where the next of kin was required to step in when poverty caused somebody to have to part with their property. It was up to the kinsman to redeem the property. The other passage is Deuteronomy 25, verse 5 to 7, where we learn that a widow shouldn't be required to look outside of the family circle in the events of being married again and finding protection. If there was a brother to her late husband, some near kinsman of that kind, he would be required to step in and be the redeemer kinsman as a matter of duty. Who then more obvious than Boaz, kinsman to Naomi's former husband Elimelech? Accordingly, she prepares Ruth for the task of making an appeal to him. She was, verse 2 of chapter 3, to wait till the day's harvesting was over, tidy herself up, make herself presentable, and verse 4, do you see it there? Have a look. Park herself down by his feet when he's retired for the night on the threshing room floor. At that point, she says, end of verse 4, he'll tell you what to do. No, it wasn't a crafty subterfuge. There was a structure surrounding all this, where duty came into its own. And it works because Naomi knows the procedure, and she knows her man, Boaz, as being entirely honorable, dependable, and worthy of Ruth's trust. Ruth, being a Gentile, would have found the procedure unfamiliar and foreign. But in trust herself, she plays her part. And after Boaz has retired for the night, she comes in quietly and lies down at his feet. And such is the strength of the framework of duty that governed the lives of those people of God, that when Boaz wakes with a little bit of a start and finds, verse 8, a woman at his feet, although he's surprised, he's not thrown by her request in verse 9, when she announces herself, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Spread your skirt over your maidservant, for you are next of kin." That was the appeal. Ruth has come under the wings of the God of Israel. Now she's looking to Boaz to be the redeemer kinsman on her behalf and take her under his wing. Yes, customs have changed. I don't know how you would react at 1 o'clock in the morning to receive a proposal of what amounts to marriage from a figure at the end of your bed whom you can't even see. But Boaz is no more thrown than if he'd been offered an early morning cup of tea. Well, he doesn't quite say yes there and then. Read what his first words are in reply to Ruth's dramatic request. There they are in verse 10. He says, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, and that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich." Young, by the way, in the sense not of age, so much as in terms of them being the smart young set. Look on at verse 12. "And now it is true that I am a near kinsman, yet there is a kinsman nearer than I. Remain this night, and in the morning, if he will do the part of the next of kin for you, well, let him do it. But if he is not willing, then as the Lord lives, I will do the part of the next of kin for you. Lie down until the morning." It's self-explanatory, of course. There's somebody else in Bethlehem who has first claim to undertake this duty. And if he's not willing to do it, well then, here I am, says Boaz, to do it. There's a code here, a procedure, a framework of duty that holds a society together. And when a place is civilized, well, then of course at that point duty comes ahead of personal desires. Think of the contrast between Boaz and a contemporary figure in the book of Judges, Israel's own leader, Samson. Judges 14 verse 2 tells us, "Samson came up and told his father and mother, 'I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife.'" Against that is Boaz. "As the Lord lives," that's where his drive and sense of duty comes from, "I will do the part of the next of kin for you." Now there may be somebody listening here in church or hearing the recording of this address, and you find yourself just now perhaps in the position of undertaking a duty, maybe as a relation or as a near neighbour on behalf of somebody else, maybe bedridden or infirm or simply placed in difficult or tragic circumstances. You find yourself, you've got that task. It's very likely your own framework of Christian understanding and God's call in your life that will provide the spark of motivation that makes the task achievable. It's not in vain if it's done for him. Every civilized society should have its own built-in framework, both of duty and security for its citizens, its children, its widows, its orphans, its shut-ins, its infirm. So just as this morning in our baptism service, what were we doing? We were setting up a framework for young Luke Frett. As Ruth and Dan and Yvonne and Norman, as the godparents, as the whole church said, we care. We want this young life to be secure, have the right framework around him forever. The framework takes over when famine strikes, as it does in Africa, or when sickness and bereavement strike, with a reminder from the book of Ruth, we are not here for ourselves. We're here for God and for others. Practice it. We must practice it now before the day of calamity and trial. Test yourself today as you go down for that coffee or fruit juice after the service. Are my attentions directed beyond my own immediate circle of friends? Have I seen that newcomer or stranger to London in our midst? Because if we can't build a framework of plain Christian duty, at least in embryo when the going is easy, well then how can we guarantee we'll perform with credit to our God when the roof caves in? What makes for a civilized society? Well, it needs to be a place where grace creates the climate and where duty provides the framework. And lastly, where providence sets the pace. For have a look at verses 14 to the end. Morning comes, and Boaz encourages Ruth to go home while it's still dark enough for her not to be seen as she returns to Naomi. No, nothing improper has taken place. No goings on in the hayloft. Even so, there's a responsibility to ensure that no cause of needless gossip or speculation or idle assumption should be created. People have to remember that these things when they're making their living plans. We're not simply private individuals living unto ourselves. We are part of a wider society. Nothing in the end is private, not when God is taken into account. So Ruth returns home, laden with extra grain that Boaz has given to her. There's something of a question mark hanging over her future as she meets Naomi and answers her questions in verses 16 and 17. And then look at verse 18, would you? It gives the clue to the mindset of Naomi. Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. It's a principle that we were reminded of in our first study from chapter 1, taken by David Turner. Did you hear that study? Hear it on the tape if you haven't heard it. The principle of divine providence runs right through this book of Ruth. And it's this sense of recognition of his providence that sets the pace in all of Naomi's thinking and planning. It's her experience, her knowledge of life, her perception of her kinsman, Boaz, and her overriding instinct for God's providence help her in the pacing of the whole matter surrounding Ruth. It will get sorted out. So wait, my daughter. Sit still. It's hard to wait. Very hard to wait when nothing is happening. When you're waiting for news of a possible job or for an answer to that letter, waiting in that frustrating in-between period of life between A and B, most of life is taken up with waiting for the next thing to happen. And it's how we face those periods that determine the kind of character a man or woman is going to turn out to be. I get the feeling that Naomi learnt it all a long time ago. Have you? Have we trained ourselves in the recognition of God's providence and ruling through prayer and patience and constantly bringing our tiny affairs and concerns under his direction? It's part of civilized living, really. Getting to the point where grace that comes from living with God creates the climate, where duty that comes from feeding on the scriptures provides the framework, and where providence sets the pace for a decision, a day, a year, an entire life. The Scotsman was right. Good plumbing is a good idea, but it can't save a civilization. Ruth and Naomi had a different approach and a more lasting one, and so did Boaz, the kinsman. Next week we'll hear what happened later that very day. Let's pray as we sit. Thank you, O Lord, for the threads running through our story as we've traced it so far. Help us to apply these great truths to our situation now in this our city, in this our church, in this our family. We ask it for your name's sake. Amen.